Today, how a Guardian investigation has shown the true extent of the crisis in children's social care in England. And just a warning before we start, there are descriptions of child abuse in this episode and references to suicide.
Why can't you go to school at the moment?
Because of the virus.
And why can't you see your grandma at the moment?
Because of the virus.
And why can't you go
to the pandemic has been incredibly hard for many children and teenagers across the country.
Coronavirus is bringing much of society to a standstill, and from Friday, it will empty the country's classrooms. Millions of children told to stay at home.
After schools shut their gates from Friday afternoon, they will remain closed for most pupils, for the vast majority of pupils, until further notice.
As Conservative MPs clamour for a plan for schools to reopen, teenagers across the country have been sharing the terrible impact of the pandemic on their mental health.
Seeing people lose their family members or not be able to go and see, you know, their parents or their grandparents, like, in case they might risk, you know, spreading it, is kind of hard.
But self-isolation and homeschooling has put more pressure on some families than others. Unemployment, addiction, and domestic violence are just a few of the factors exacerbated by COVID that means some parents are unable to give their children the home life they need. Now, a Guardian investigation has revealed how councils are struggling as more and more children are being referred to social services or need to go into care. But increasingly, that care just isn't there. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, how the pandemic exposed a broken system for children's social care. Helen Bidd, you are The Guardian's North of England editor, and you've been looking into the state of children's social services. What have you found that has really stuck with you?
What's stuck in my mind most is a terrible story involving a 12-year-old boy in Wigan in Greater Manchester. I came across his story via a judgment that a High Court judge made back in July. He'd been known to social services since 2011, so since he was probably about two, following an allegation that his dad was misusing drugs and alcohol, and he'd been making threats against the boy's mother and her children. And one of those threats was the dad saying that he was going to gas them, blow the house up, slit the children's throats while they were sleeping. For almost all of this 12-year-old boy's short life, social services have supposedly been keeping a close eye on what was going on with him. And he's largely been living with his dad in recent years, despite numerous worrying incidents. And things really escalated during the pandemic last year. Like, he turned up at school in October saying he hadn't eaten for 3 days. Oh, wow. He had various unexplained injuries, including broken fingers. He had burnt hair. And then in February this year, he told his school therapist that he wanted to kill himself.
Oh, my gosh.
It's just, it's horrendous, absolutely horrendous. There'd been this series of increasingly troubling events. And during this, his father was completely failing to engage with the local council, and he apparently ripped up copies of letters from the local authority in front of the social worker. So it was clear that he was not doing his job as a father to look after his son. And the decision was taken to take the boy into care, into a children's home, a residential care placement. Oh. And that's when he got taken to hospital.
This is quite a story to come across, Helen, and clearly this is a child with very complex needs. What happened when he got to hospital?
He was very agitated, very combative, blue in the face, and they had to restrain him. They had to strap his legs together, and they had to cover his face with a guard to stop him spitting and biting, and they had to kind of chemically restrain him using drugs to calm him down. So it was clearly a really, really distressed little boy. And then the question arose, well, what do we do with him now? And what happened at this point was that a hospital did a mental health risk assessment, which concluded that, yes, he's extremely vulnerable, complex set of difficulties. But the psychiatrist ruled that he was not mentally ill enough to be given one of an increasingly rare number of children's mental health beds. They're called tier four beds. And the psychiatrist said, you know, this boy would benefit from being in a care setting where he has regular, experienced staff who know how to deal with children with complex needs and who can build up trust and relationships with him. But the problem was that there was no such placement. There was nowhere for this boy to go. So the local authority, Wigan Council in this case, applied to the High Court and asked a judge to deprive this boy of his liberty and to keep him in hospital.
I mean, what impact was this having on staff and at the hospital itself? You know, this sounds like a case that they're not usually trained or equipped to deal with.
Yeah. And this is not a special mental health hospital. This is an ordinary hospital, which doesn't have psychiatric services for young people. So he was put on a normal children's ward, a paediatric ward, and his behaviour just escalated. He was increasingly difficult to manage. The police were being called regularly. At one point, there were 15 police officers on the children's ward who were all trying to restrain him because he was so distressed. He tried all different kinds of ways to hurt himself, to the point that they had to take all of his clothes off and put him in medical scrubs because there was no cords or anything that he could use. And it got to a point where they had to close off half of his ward and move some really seriously ill children to other hospitals. They had to cancel all elective procedures for children, which meant that, you know, children who might have been waiting a long time for really important operations couldn't have them. And it was clearly a completely unsustainable situation where the state's failure to find a suitable placement for this boy was having a detrimental effect on other seriously ill and vulnerable children.
I mean, it's just horrific, the whole situation. And he was literally there because they didn't have anywhere else to take him.
Yeah. He needed to have a secure placement with really experienced staff. And there is there's a massive shortage in the system.
So this boy became so difficult to manage that the local authority, Wigan Council, applied to the High Court to keep him in hospital. What happened during that hearing?
The barrister representing the local authority said, in 30 years practicing as a barrister, it's the most shameful application he's had to make in terms of what he was asking this court to do. And he said to the judge, you're going to have to choose between the lesser of two evils. Either this boy goes out onto the streets or you detain him in a completely unsuitable place. And the judge decided not to grant the application to further detain this child on the unsuitable paediatric ward and said it's just not a solution which can be countenanced in a civilised society.
When you were reading that judgment, did you get a sense of what the judge was thinking, what his thoughts were on this case?
I was just so appalled reading this judgment, and I thought, how, you know, this has got to be a one-off. But what's clear when you read the judgment is that it's not a one-off. It's just the latest in a series of absolutely dismaying, horrifying cases which the judges are having to deal with. And at one point in the judgment, Mr. Justice McDonald says, in what will be a scenario now depressingly familiar to those in the habit of reading High Court judgments involving children with acute emotional and behavioural difficulties. And this is far from the first such case that he's had to deal with. But what he did do that was quite unusual is that he wanted to use this case to raise awareness, to kind of raise the alarm, really. So he sent a copy of his judgment to Gavin Williamson, the Education Secretary, as well as other relevant ministers, the Children's Commissioner, and also the man who's in charge of the independent review into children's social care.
It's pretty shocking that the judge said elements of this case weren't unusual. And you reported that he ordered Wigan Council to find a specialist community placement, and the boy has been found somewhere to live in the short term, but the search goes on for a long-term option. You mentioned that his situation deteriorated significantly during the pandemic, and you've been looking at the impact COVID is having on children's services in England. What have you found?
So I conducted a series of interviews with directors of children's services at various local authorities, and I particularly chose local authorities which are high on the government's index of multiple deprivation. And for example, in Middlesbrough, which is classed as the most income-deprived local authority in England, there'd been a 40% rise in children referred to social services in the last year. So that's pretty massive. In Hull, the number of children in care has risen 9% year on year, and a chronic shortage of foster carers meant that there were 55 children in Hull who were looked after by the local authority who moved between seven or more placements between June 2020 and June 2021. If you look at Knowsley in Merseyside, the second most income-deprived local authority in England, they last year had a 26% increase in the number of domestic abuse notifications and the number of children and young people who were identified as being criminally exploited.
Those are huge increases in demand for children's services in the past year then. What's really going on? I mean, what impact has the pandemic and all the lockdowns we've been through had on children and families?
By their very nature, children's social services are dealing with the most vulnerable and often very chaotic families. And when you add a pandemic into the mix and you add the closure of schools, you have a very worrying situation which really opens these children up to further neglect and abuse. Although it's probably worth stating that schools in England never actually closed fully, and they were always open to look after children and vulnerable children. But in many cases, maybe their parents were not the most motivated to force the children to go into school. So there were quite a lot of children who just kind of went AWOL, really.
You describe the many ways the pandemic has had a huge impact on people's lives and a children's service system that is struggling to cope. How much of this current crisis, though, is down to COVID?
I think you could argue that the pandemic is perhaps the straw that broke the camel's back, but this has been a storm that has been brewing for a long time. And there's kind of a clear path that you can trace from 2010, when the Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition came into power and decided that they were going to cut the budgets of local authorities who were responsible for caring for vulnerable children. And it reminds me of a phrase used by Josh McAllister, who's leading the review into children's social care. And he's described the children's services system as a tower of Jenga held together by sellotape. It's incredibly precarious. And all of these departments, despite there being an increased need, have actually seen their budgets slashed over the last 11 years.
I think this has been a crisis that's been long predicted. It's been long in the making.
Patrick Butler is The Guardian's social policy editor. And over the past decade, he's reported on how cuts to council budgets have made it harder for them to carry out their legal duty of securing the welfare of their most vulnerable children.
And I think what's happened in the last few years is essentially two things. First, we've seen huge stress on vulnerable families and communities more widely as a result of austerity. So there's increasing need, there's increasing child poverty. So much more stress and pressure on families, particularly vulnerable families, particularly low-income families. And the second thing is that councils have had less resources to deal with it. What's been taken away is the early intervention service. Early intervention is when, ideally, you can get to the families that are starting to have problems or small crises, might be a teenager going off the rails, might be a young mum struggling to cope with her child, might be a family with domestic abuse problems. If you can reach families at this point and nip those problems in the bud, get the family to address these problems, help them to overcome them, then what that often means is that the family can recover, that they could stabilise, and that an acute intervention, which is where children are, you know, in the most extreme case, taken from the family and put into care, doesn't happen. So it's about going upstream and solving the problem before it becomes a much bigger problem further down the line. So by taking away all that early intervention, what you were doing was allowing family problems to just get worse and worse and worse. And I think you're seeing two consequences of that. One is the impact on the child and the family, which is often can be catastrophic. I mean, not always. Sometimes it's right that we take children into care, but it's not always good for the family. And secondly, we can see that it's costing a huge amount of money.
Why is it costing so much money? I mean, why is this so expensive?
It's a lot cheaper to do early intervention. If you're just spending on picking up the pieces, that's where it gets expensive. Now, there's one area of children's services which is particularly known for its expense, and that's children's residential care. Now, children's residential care is less than 10% of all children in care. That's where children are taken from their families, and they're put in a, you know, what used to be called a children's home, you know, a residential facility. And those facilities can be extraordinarily expensive.
How much are we talking here? I mean, can you give us an example of what it might cost for a council to put a child into residential care?
Well, it varies, and it all depends on the kind of services that are provided. But where we're talking hugely vulnerable children that need a lot of support, perhaps 24-hour support in very secure facilities, then it can be eye-wateringly expensive. We're talking £200,000 a year, £250,000 a year in some cases, and a lot of councils are now thinking, just how sustainable is this?
That seems like an extraordinary amount of money to me. How did we get to a situation where councils are paying so much to house children in residential care?
There were, of course, a series of scandals in the 1980s, 1990s. Councils often closed their homes, and it was seen as very unfashionable to have residential care. Other forms of care, such as fostering, were seen as preferable for often very good reasons. And as a result of that, the residential care became much more specialised, and it also became largely run by the private sector. And it's private companies that run about 80% of the children's residential home market. And I think the worry is that the market isn't working, and that maybe, you know, looking after vulnerable children in care, is this really an area of public services that we should be really exposing to profit motive? A study published earlier this year by the Local Government Association suggests that you know, the profits that private homes or some private homes are making are astonishing. They estimate that the six biggest private children's care home providers made £219 million in profit last year. That is kind of eye-watering, really, and this is shocking a lot of people. So, for example, a few weeks ago, there was a parliamentary committee hearing in which Lord Adonis and Anne Longfield, the former children's commissioner, were giving evidence. And Lord Adonis memorably was gobsmacked when the annual fees that councils were paying for children's homes were mentioned.
I mean, those figures Anne was just quoting, I find incredible. I had no idea that local authorities were paying £250,000 a year for a child. I mean, this is absolutely unbelievable. This makes Eton, Westminster and Winchester look like cut price.
He was absolutely astonished. He was in care himself as a child. And I think the point that Anne Longfield made very strongly was that, look, we're paying all this money, huge amounts of money to put children into residential care. But what is the quality of the care provided, and what are the outcomes that we have after this huge investment in children?
When I first heard of, you know, the adolescent that was, it cost £1 million to look after them for 4 years, the really shocking part was that the commissioning authority couldn't say that those children were in a better place at the end of it than the beginning. And all of those combined really means for me a system that's not working.
The opportunities, their life chances, if you like, are significantly worse than children who aren't in care. You know, they're less likely to go on to university. They're more likely to end up in prison, for example. So I think it's one of the questions that we ask when we talk about reform is, you know, how can we guarantee that we are going to get a good social return on the investment on children in residential care.
Right, so that's the long-term impact of poor residential care. But the amount this is costing councils, what does that mean for local authorities now?
Children's services probably account for maybe 30% of a council budget. Now, if you put children's social services and adult social services together, in many councils, that now accounts for up to 70%, between 60 and 70% of all the council spending.
Yes.
Now, if you go back 10 years, it was probably nearer 40%,
wow.
45%.
That's such a huge difference.
It's a huge difference. And if you look more widely at the council budget as a whole, the council spending has probably gone down by 30% over the last 10 years. So council spending has gone down by a third, so the cake is a lot smaller. And the two arms of social services are taking up an increasingly big slice of that cake. And what that means is that the ability of the council to spend on other services, whether that's parks or an extensive library system, that kind of thing, all those services are suffering because the councils have to spend so much on social care.
And I think what you're saying in the case of councils is it's created this vicious cycle. You know, you remove the preventative services or at least cut funding to them, and it means more children presumably are coming directly into the care system. There are more children who need this support now than ever, and the amount of money that's needed for that is also increasing at a time when councils are having budget cuts. I mean, it just keeps going and going.
When we talk about, well, what needs to change, I think one of the key things is breaking this cycle where we're not intervening to help support families and children before things spiral out of control.
Coming up, how can we fix the care system for children in England? Patrick, from what you're saying, this system was broken long before COVID, but the pandemic has just made it worse. Hannah mentioned that the government has launched a review of children's social care, which is being headed up by a man called Josh McAllister, a former teacher who runs a social work charity. This review is being described as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but do people working in the sector have confidence in it?
I think when Josh McAllister was appointed and you know, the review got underway, I think there was a sense in which, do they really mean it? You know, how bold are they? How ambitious are they? Is this just going to be a kind of tinkering around the edges? That was the worry. You know, are we going to end up with a kind of, well, let's set up an academy schools type system for child protection services? You know, let's introduce new markets into child protection. That was the worry. And I think a few months on, Josh McAllister has published his case for change. And I think people are now feeling a lot more optimistic that Josh McAllister is listening to not only to people in the system, not only people who work in the system, but children who are in the care system themselves. He's listening, and that he's got a pretty good idea of probably what needs to change.
What do people you speak to who work in this area say that they think needs to change, that they would like to see recommended?
And it's really boring because it's not just about the money in some ways, but more money is needed. And we're probably talking billions of pounds. I think there are other areas that need looking at. Children's residential care, as we've discussed. And I think a clear commitment to early intervention. But I think there's a second area that lots of people are very keen on, and that's the wider picture of, I suppose, the wider environment for vulnerable children in this country. So not just a structural reform, a kind of tinkering, you know, around the edges. There might be a bit of that, but actually what we need to see is a much more ambitious commitment to children across the board. You know, we need a plan, for example, to erase child poverty, which has been on the rise and getting worse over the last few years. Now, that's outside of the scope of children's services. You know, so I think we need to look just beyond reforming children's services. We need to look at the wider situation for families, particularly lower income families.
Helen, what reaction have you had to your report about the 12-year-old boy in Wigan?
I mean, there's been kind of shock and dismay from people like me who were not actually experts in children's care, but there's been sort of resigned kind of, yeah, we told you so. We've been saying this for a long time from experts. They didn't seem so shocked. They were just like, yeah, this is how bad it's got. And they're saying that surely if this kind of case doesn't make the government wake up and think, right, we have to intervene. We can't have this. You know, as the judge said, you can't have this in a civilised society. Then what will make the government wake up and change the system?
What have you come away from it feeling?
I feel a bit ashamed of society. You know, we're one of the richest countries in the world, and yet we are clearly failing our most vulnerable children. And it's kind of galvanised me to do more reporting in this area and to push for change, really.
Helen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Helen Pidd and Patrick Butler. Do go and read all the reporting on the impact the pandemic has had on children's services at theguardian.com, which includes Helen's report about the 12-year-old boy, Patrick's analysis, and Maya Wolf-Robinson's interview with a social worker on the struggle to protect at-risk children. If you have been affected by anything we've talked about in this episode, you can contact Samaritans on 116 123, or you can email jo@samaritans.org. And if you are worried that a child you know is at risk from abuse or you need some advice, contact the NSPCC. Their website is nspcc.org.uk and their helpline number is 0808 800 5000. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back tomorrow.